Good. Ready to start the next section. Okay.
Yes. Hello, everyone. My name is Urs Gasser. I'm delighted to welcome you to our Track B panel on trust, reputation, and community building. Since it's our first Track B panel, let me give you some background. So far, we've been discussing the legal, policy, and technological issues of creating an open and secure identity layer. This panel, however, approaches the topic digital identity from a slightly different and hopefully complementary perspective. The starting point is what Charlie Nessen pointed out at the very beginning of this conference. Cyberspace is a rhetorical space, is clearly a message space where different kinds of signals are exchanged. And indeed, identities both in the offline world and the online world emerge and evolve in and through social processes, through interactions. So this panel seeks to introduce a third perspective in addition to the technological and probably legal policy perspective on the identity debate. It seeks to explore the role of social interactions, processes, and mechanisms, including, for instance, trust and reputation. And it seeks to discuss some of the challenges associated with building online communities and channeling social interactions. So, against this backdrop, the discussion here includes two elements. First of all, an analytical, and second, more a normative element or component. From an analytical perspective, we'd like to learn more about the basic ingredients, as it is written in the program, for and concepts of community building. This includes social signaling, for instance, reciprocity, reputation, and trust. But second, we would like to launch a normative debate. Once we better understand some of the basic concepts just mentioned, how shall we implement, apply them at the design level of platforms, of systems such as Second Life? To explore these issues, we're very fortunate to have a group of, although incomplete group today as it turns out, a group of experts here. On the panel, Judith Donath, director of the Sociable Media Research Group at MIT Media Lab, Robin Harber, VP Community Development and Support with Linden Lab, and Kevin McCabe, Professor of Economics and Law at George Mason University. Each panelist will speak to us for roughly 10 minutes, and I'd like to start with Judith, actually, followed by Kevin, and then I suggest that we have a first 10 minutes Q&A before we continue with Robin, and hopefully Walter Bender will show up in the meantime as a final speaker. And then, of course, again, Q&A and open discussion. So, Judith, what can we learn from social signaling theory, and how does it link to this question of identity in the digital space?
Hi. What I'm going to talk about today is looking at a lot of social interaction through the framework of signaling theory, which started as a theory in the field of biology, looking at communication among animals, among cells, etc. And what I'm interested in is how we can apply a lot of the principles from this theory to human signaling and human communication. And so what I'm going to do in this very whirlwind introduction to these concepts today is first talk about briefly what the theory is, and then talk a little bit about what are some of the things that are very different about applying it to human behavior. And So first we'll talk about signals and signaling theory. The notion here is that signals are the perceivable, most of the things that we or animals or anything want to know about each other are hidden qualities. I want to know if you're a nice person. I want to know if you would be a good father to our potential future children. I want to know if you actually like the cake that I baked. These are all hidden qualities. There's no way for us to directly see any of these aspects about another person. For an animal, they also want to know if that one's going to be a good father for their children. They want to know if this other one is strong enough to make it worth fighting for this territory or not, etc. And again, those are hidden qualities. Since so many things of interest we can't see, what we rely on instead are signals. And those are the perceivable traits, something that we can see that represents more or less reliably the hidden quality that is the thing that is really of interest to us. And what signaling theory is about is understanding the relationship between these perceivable qualities, the perceivable signals, and the qualities we're hoping to learn from about them. And the first thing to keep in mind is that as a theory, we're really only interested in it in situations of competition. When there's absolute cooperation, everyone has exactly the same motivations, we don't really need any theory because there's no reason to be deceptive. We don't have to worry about reliability. But an awful lot of our interactions with each other are competitive in some way. Now, obviously, you know, we can think of periods of great competition. You know, right now, the United States is in competition with North Korea, and there's all kinds of ways of looking at this from signaling. What the adversity there is apparent. But even in a situation like this, perhaps I'm trying to seem smarter to you than maybe I actually am, and you're trying to figure out if I actually know what I'm talking about. You know, that, I mean, whenever we are interacting with other people, we're always trying to make a good impression on them, which is often a little bit deceptive about we're smarter, we're more interesting, we're nicer than we really are. And the other person wants to know, what are we really like? So most of our interactions really do have some level of competition to them. So once we have that, we have motivations for deception, and then we get into these issues that signaling theory deals with, which is how do we know if something is deceptive or not? And one of the basic tenets in signaling theory, and there are entire books on this, we're going to spend about 30 seconds on it, is that wasteful costs lead to reliability. That this is what Thorsten Veblen was looking at when he was talking about conspicuous consumption, that if you have enough of some given resource to waste it, that's a signal of the reliability of your possession of that resource. Secondly, when there is not wasteful signaling like that, society can still, and this is more among humans, so it turns out it happens among sparrows and various other animals, people can step in and have laws or other social sanctions that can add externally the costs that make a signal reliable. If I want to get through traffic, it may be convenient for me to put a siren on the top of my car and pretend to be a police officer. That's a non-costly signal. It's actually turns out you can buy these on the net really easily and just speed through traffic. It's not that the signal in that case is expensive. I don't have to go to police school. I don't actually be a policeman or going to help anyone. But it turns out society puts a lot of sanctions on that kind of behavior. So it turns, because of the social sanctions, it becomes too costly for me to do that, and I and everyone else sit in traffic. So punishment also keeps signals reliable. In the animal world, some of the prototypical examples of these the costly signals are things such as the giant horns that moose and other animals have. These are very costly in terms of the metabolic cost that they have. You're expending a great deal of strength just to hold your head up with horns such as these, and that is why in competitive situations where one moose is looking at another and seeing, is it worth fighting with you? What's to be gained or lost is tremendous. It's territory, it's the rights to mate with the females in the area, but they may end up not fighting at all because they can assess each other through these horns and say, okay, I'm not going to bother to fight with you because I will lose so badly that it's even worse than losing this territory. There's no reason to lose my life and the territory at once. So here the horns have to be costly because it has to be honest, or else they would always have to actually fight every single time to make that assessment. In the human world, there's obvious signals, for instance, of wealth. You know, you can waste money on cars, on jewelry. Again, this is Thorsten Veblen 100 years ago, presaged a lot of this theory. Furs. I use the fur example because it's an interesting one. I will get away from the theory for a minute to remember that, especially in terms of humans, we don't really know whether this is true in the animal world, but there's one of the big issues that we have to understand about signaling is that all of these things gain their meaning in subjective experience. So one may decide to put on a beautiful fur coat and a fur hat because you want to signal both wealth and good taste. The person you are signaling it to may interpret it as a sign that you are cruel to animals. That is an unintended interpretation. So a lot of the work that goes into understanding how to apply this theory in terms of human interaction also gets into the questions of the semiotics of signaling. How do things start to have their meaning? And this is very, very important in the design world when we're building things like Second Life and all these other spaces where we're really creating enormous numbers of new vocabularies of signals and what their meanings are. Understanding this social economics that underlies them helps us understand why particular ones may be very well suited for certain things, why some may be inherently reliable. But we need to understand as designers that meaning is always subjective and is always going to be open to multiple interpretations. You know, it's very easy to look at the moose and say these horns, you know, simple signal strength. It may be more complex in the animal world. And certainly in the human world, as we look into it, there's always a number of conflating possibilities. Different people may do similar things for different reasons. And so the interpretation has to be done within a large set of social and cultural factors. So two examples I want to give of things that I think are very interesting types of signals to think about in the design of new spaces today are the questions of signals of fashion and signals of risk-taking. And so one hypothesis I want to put forth here is that fashion is a signal of information, access, and adaptability. We often think of fashion as being sort of this silly, flighty thing that's kind of a waste of time, and by now you might already realize that often this notion of waste within this way of looking at the world is a sign that something may be potentially quite meaningful. And the idea that I'd like to present you with to think about is to think about the idea of how of fashions, and by here what I mean by fashion, I'm going to give you some examples, these are all sort of in the information world, is a signal where the thing that is being, the quality that's being signaled, which is often status and one's position in society, this thing that you're signaling remains the same, but the form of the signal is continuously changing. And these four are just four contemporary things. One is Crazy Frog, which is this one here. This was, you know, this the number one ringtone for I forget how long. It was, you know, by far the biggest hit in the ringtone market. And things like ringtones, I think, are really, really interesting. The music world as a whole is a very, very fashion-driven space, and it really is about saying, I have access to the people who are making this new scene. I know the cool music right now. How much time and effort you want to invest in knowing what club to go to be the first person to know something, or to wait and only display your knowledge once, you know, you are there with your coterie of a million other people is a clear fashion hierarchy. And one of the things we're seeing with something like Crazy Frog as a ringtone, which I think is really interesting, is the movement of that type of thing to the sort of personal information accessory that, you know, our cell phones and other mobile devices are becoming. And it's a way of seeing that a cell phone really is a personal display. It's not just a communication device. This painting is by John Curran, who's, you know, a top, he's just hit the, I think, $2 million mark on his paintings. But the art world is an extreme example of a fashion-driven society where people make enormous bets on what kind of painting is going to be popular next. And it's very much in that realm of saying, once you're going to buy expensive art, people, you know, if you're a newly rich hedge fund manager, then you have to hire art consultants to show you around this world. There's been a number of legal cases recently where people were not allowed to buy paintings because they weren't considered by the various dealers cool enough. So there's a to get the most fashionable paintings. So, and then blogs clearly are this example of how we're now using things like link structure. What are the things that people start to link to on a daily basis as a way of showing who has the fastest access to information? If you start to look at the patterns by which links move around the net, there's the people who are the trendsetters who may be spending 6 hours a day full time looking for a really interesting new story that they can put out so that all their followers, who may be only spending 45 minutes a day going to the 10 sites they know will help them harvest today's link fashion, will put them up. And I think it's an interesting thing to think about. The whole history of fashion has been, if we look at it from the 14th century, where fashion's moved about once or twice a year, to today, where we're seeing something as an hourly basis. If we do posit this as a way of saying, in a world in which information is increasingly fast moving and increasingly important, we are spending enormous amounts of time keeping up with ever increasing rates of fashion changes and ways of how we have to display on a hourly, if not, you know, soon minute by minute basis, where we are in this information food chain. This is just a summary of that. I'm going to go through that quickly. And then the last one I want to think about is this notion of signals of daring. These are just, which I think is interesting, and it's something we often don't think about because, and we're just left with economists shaking their head and saying, well, people are rational, we can't understand why they're doing these things. One of the things that's very interesting, this is suntanning and smoking were the two examples I wanted to think about, especially among teenagers and adolescents. One of the sort of prototypical stories in anthropology that deals with signaling is that in some tribe, unfortunately I've forgotten their name, in Africa, there's enormous amount of fame and status goes to young men who aren't the ones who bring home the most food for everyone, but the ones who volunteer to go out on the lion hunts, because about half of them get eaten in the process. But of the ones who come home with a lion, uneaten themselves, they get all the girls, they have all the fame, they have all the status. We have, you know, and it is an example of how much people want to reward risk-taking behavior. And I think I'm going to posit that this is something that's very deep-seated in human society, and that a lot of times, and especially perhaps among adolescents, and particularly maybe adolescent males, whether this is biological or cultural, I'm going to leave to some other argument. But so one of the things that's very interesting is that there's a lot of behaviors, such as tanning and smoking, that for a large segment of the population, the more you tell people that this is really bad for you, it's not that they're ignoring the warning, and it's not so much that they're thinking that it doesn't apply to them. It's that that is, in fact, what makes it attractive. The fact that it's bad for you is the thing that's... And so we need to think about how, if we want to change people's behavior, how we want to present things such as warnings about safe sex and smoking and tanning. And I want to just leave it... this is just a quick grab from my space, was we were having conversations at dinner last night about, and, you know, and this has been a big topic this spring and in the last year or so, about people's personal stake in protection of their own privacy. And why are, you know, teenagers blithely putting up naked pictures of themselves on web pages when they keep being told, you know, it's going to be really hard to get a job like that. And, you know, if you, you know, sit here and list all the drugs that you've taken and have pictures of your sex life online in perpetuity. And I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is that these things may function as signals of risk-taking and daring. And so understanding, if we look at these things in terms of signals, understanding what something is signaling is very, very important to understanding why people behave in ways that may seem seemingly irrational. And I think it's one of the contributions of looking at things from a signaling perspective is that a lot of seemingly wasteful behavior, irrational behavior, makes sense when you see it, when you understand what it's actually trying to indicate as a personal quality. Thank you.
So, Kevin, would you be kind enough to introduce two other key concepts in this context of community building, which is trust and reputation?
Okay. So, what I want to talk about is another side of the social interaction, and that is how do people manage social risk? And I want to talk about that from. I want to start with an idea by an economist, Douglas North, who won the Nobel Prize in economics for studying why certain countries enjoy high economic growth and other countries don't. And he made a really interesting observation, which is that countries that have had trouble sustaining economic growth are one that depend too strongly on personal exchange to get markets to work. And that the countries that succeed in sustaining high levels of economic growth are the ones that can rely more on institutions and impersonal exchange to make markets work. Now, that kind of led to a bunch of research we've been doing lately. We study people both in the behavioral laboratory, and then we study what's going on in their brain as they make economic decisions. That's the neuroeconomics term. And one of the things we've been interested in is how the brain's designed to engage in two kinds of activities simultaneously, but also often in conflict with each other. And what is what I would call the problem of optimal use? That is, if you give me a set of rules and constraints, the brain is designed very well to try to maximize its benefits given those sets of rules and constraints. On the other hand, if you put me in a social group, the brain is also designed to try to manage optimal control of a situation by gaining property rights, et cetera, and access through other individuals' actions, coalition formation, and so on. And we operate all the time in both settings, both in the organizational settings of the world and the institutional settings of the world. And in fact, I find the questions of identity that were brought up this morning as very much kind of paralleling those kind of issues. Is this a question of optimal use? Do we create identity to improve people's chances to use an institution? Or is it a question of optimal control? Does it allow us to see what people are doing, monitor how they're behaving, and so on? Let me show you a really simple game on trust that we got interested in doing. This is called the investment trust game. It's a really simple game, so I'll explain it to you. Two players are given $10 each when they show up to the lab. Player one can then choose to invest up to $10 in $1 increments with player two. Every dollar they send to player two is tripled, and both players know that. So there's a return on investment for making the investment. What's the catch? Well, player two then decides how much to send back to player one, and that's no longer player one's choice, okay? So the question is, do you trust player one? I just put this slide up to remind myself to mention to you, we run this experiment completely anonymously. In other words, we've got a design where not even the experimenter knows what individual subjects are doing in the experiment, let alone your partner. Now, as an economist, when we first started doing this research, we thought we had this problem nailed. This is standard game theory from an economics perspective. Let's assume that both players prefer more money to less, and they both know that. And let's assume that both players know that that's the truth. and they expect each other to behave in their self-interest, then what does the theory predict? Player two will keep all the money if you send it to them. Player one should realize this and send zero. And the question is this how people play? Because the problem with that solution is it leaves all the money with who? The experimenter, instead of with the people trying to make the money. Okay, well, let's look at what happens. Here's some results. If you look at the red dots, that's the amount sent by various participants. This has been ordered, N equals 32 subjects, but I've ordered the data from highest amount sent to lowest amount sent. Now, as you'll notice, there's about a third to a little more than a third reciprocity, in the sense that people that are sent money actually return more money than they get. There's also a fair amount of cheating. So there is both reciprocity and cheating going on in this very, very simple world. Now, let me ask you the following question, though. To an economist, this would have made no sense. So I'm not sure exactly how we got thinking along these lines. But what would happen if we took a second group, brought them in, and told them what the first group did, but then had them play the game? So all they get is a social history of what the other group does. Here's the answer. You get far more cooperation. So the simple signals of cooperative types from the first experiment have increased the amount of cooperation in the second experiment. That's a powerful thing. And that doesn't require you to have a rule of law in place saying that you're going to punish people if they fail and so on. I think that's a very important point, is that if you can make it in people's interest to see the value of cooperation, they'll often figure that out. Does that mean you should always trust people to be cooperative? No. But let me go on now and show you a second set of experiment using reputations. Slightly different design. If you're a buyer, you were given a demand value on the top of the schedule. So you might have been given that second step on the demand schedule, 275. If you're a seller, you were given a unit cost, say maybe the 125, second to highest unit cost schedule. Then all the buyers and sellers were matched together and told to bargain with each other over price, not knowing what the other person's value or cost is. Okay, so just bargain over a price. When you finish bargaining, if you agree to a price, then one of two things is going to happen. Either we're going to execute the contract for you, or we're going to let you execute the contract, which means the buyer has to send the seller the money. The seller has to send the buyer a unit. Okay, and the contract is completed only if those two things happen. Now, under that second treatment where we allowed manual contracting, we then wanted to know what would happen if we allowed a reputational system to be involved in ranking or rating people who decided whether or not to send the unit or send the money. Because you can see there's a contract failure just waiting to happen here with people failing to live up to their side of the deal. We looked at two reputation reporting systems. One was automatic, where we reported truthfully whether or not the other person fulfilled their side of the contract. The second system was manual, where we required the other person to voluntarily say whether or not the other person fulfilled their contract. And they could choose three options. They could say they executed, meaning they sent the unit or they sent the money. They can report they didn't execute, which means they didn't send it. Or they could simply choose not to report in the manual system. Now, first off, what does this do data-wise? Well, if you look at the automatic contracting, this is the one on the far left-hand side. This is the efficiency. This is how much gains from trade people took off the table and got for themselves from the experimenter. And basically, when we executed the contracts for them, 90% of the efficiency was achieved. The 10% that failed were actually cases where people failed to reach a bargaining agreement. That's the main 10% failure. Now, notice if you go over to the third one, that's manual contracting without reputation. So basically, it drops to a medium of about 50% efficiency when you have to rely on the other people executing the contract. And by the way, if the seller sends the unit, that generates all the surplus, whether the buyer sends the money or not. So it even includes the fact that sellers are frequently being cheated on in that case. Sometimes sellers are cheating too, but that's a different issue. If you look then at the automatic reporting, AREP, the second one, or the manual reporting, what do you notice? There's no significant difference between whether we did the reporting for the subjects or whether they did the reporting themselves. Now, that's interesting for the following reason. This is kind of just a typical experiment with 12 subjects that were contracting with each other. This is manual reporting, and these are the reports sent by the subject. And you'll notice the purple, which is basically lying, that is telling the opposite of what the person did in terms of your reporting. And what you can see is there's a consistent kind of sub-element of misreporting going on in this manual reporting system. Now, it could be we didn't run this experiment long enough for the misreporting to have a cumulative effect. But it could also be that a certain amount of misreporting is tolerated by these reputation systems because it's the tracking feature of the system that people are worried about and not the reports themselves. You could test that, and we did, by asking how informative are the reputation reports? That is, how much do people use them in shaping their strategy? And while people use them, they don't use them very efficiently. So in fact, even though the reports are there, it's more the fact that the reporting exists that's keeping people in line than the fact that our subjects were using the reports all that efficiently. I just want to end with two open questions that are some research questions I'm interested in at this point. And one question is, when you start talking about identity, and you start talking about people belonging to different groups, you'd like to see how that group formation emerges endogenously with the problem that people solve. And so my first question is, can you design a joint decision-making scenario where different people would have different criteria for what it means to cooperate? That is, could you have different cultures emerging around a problem that people face that would lead them to want to solve the problem differently, although each group thinks it's solving it cooperatively? The second question I have has to do with this idea of measuring reputation. And there's two approaches to measuring reputation. We could allow groups to define what measures go into constructing a reputation, that is, allow the group to define what it is to be a good member of your group. And we can allow that to emerge endogenously, or we could require that to be done by some organization of the group deciding what's in the group's interest. The second question is, how do you use group affiliation? That is, should your reputation for in-group measures be weighted more by how other members of your group are rating you? That is, if a member with a high ranking in your group ranks you highly, then should that count more than if a member out of your group ranks you highly? And so on. That's all I have to say for now. Thanks.
Thank you very much. So we have time for maybe two or three brief questions. Before we do that, however, let me welcome Walter Bender, who arrived in the meantime, MIT Media Lab and President for Software and Content Development of the One Laptop Per Child Initiative. Welcome. Now, where are the microphones, actually? There is a question.
I was wondering if the...
Please say your name.
I'm sorry?
Your name, please.
My name is Michael Rand, and I was wondering if the presenters could talk about how cultural, religious, or ethnic differences might affect the data, or you know, have led to different differences. In other words, for example, do ethnic, religious, or other similar social group differences make a difference in the outcomes of the experiments and the work you've done with the technology?
Do you want to talk about the experiments?
Sure. Anything you can talk about? Yeah. So I'll just briefly talk about experiments. One of the things that's been done is the anthropologists have picked up on this behavioral laboratory research and gone out to hunter-gatherer societies to look at very different agrarian versus hunting societies and so on, to look at whether there are cultural differences in the way people play the investment game and also a similar game that I didn't have a chance to talk about, the ultimatum game. The answer is there are large cultural differences, but the question is what constitutes your concept of culture, of which people are making, what makes the difference inside the culture? That is, could the same culture generate the same differences if it simply had access to the same kinds of emergent institutions and so on of the other culture and so on? Nobody knows that answer. But what we do know is cross-culturally, when you just simply take these experiments across the world, you get major differences.
Another way of thinking about it is I think it's useful to think of all kinds of cross-cultural differences as existing within sort of a multi-scale of cultures, that we deal with some level of cultural differences anytime we communicate with somebody else. And a lot of our communication, for one thing, is about trying to figure out what your common ground is. And then within that, we spend an enormous amount of time. If you ask for specific examples, I think a very good one is simply how, when we're communicating online, when we deal only with text, we lose many, many of the cues that let us know in a spoken environment how different the cultural background of the person we're speaking with is. It's fairly easy if everyone is typing in English to not hear that someone has an accent that would clue you into understanding that their cultural references are different, that they are understanding of what is a deferential way of speaking versus a passive way of speaking versus being aggressive versus simply being clear, are going to be very deep. And so what we need to understand when we build environments are, at that level of identity, to what extent do we, in a particular environment, want to make it clear that we don't see a lot of the cues about how culturally different someone else is. This comes up a lot in the debates about whether women are treated differently online and whether people can hide gender differences, because it's not simply a matter of being able to talk about particular topics, but that people have a very, very long, deep training about how to use the passive voice in sentences, when to frame a request as a question, and that if you don't know anything about the person you're speaking to gender, usually you'll assume it's a man. If you're mistaken, if someone's not even trying to hide something, but they just haven't paraded the fact that, someone relatively gender indifferent name is actually a woman, the level of misunderstanding can be very high. So I think that a lot of it is about understanding what aspects of identity in particular circumstances are essential for understanding what level of cultural differences you need to know.
Thank you. Is there another question? Who actually wrote the top-ranked question? This person may want to ask the question now. No one in here, obviously. So it's
it was a question on my question. So the reason why I raised that question is for, in some sense, that question. I wasn't sure what people knew about this. In general, I've been spending some time starting to look at what you'd have to think about for reputational mechanisms in metaverse contexts like Second Life, and that leads to some really interesting questions of how do you define the content over which the reputation should be formed? Who should have access, or who should be defining that content? Who should use it, and how generalizable is a reputation measure once it's been defined over specific content? Anyway, that's good.
Thank you very much. I suggest we turn now to Robin. And Robin, given your rich experiences with Second Life and this vibrant community place and space, what's the role of trust in building virtual societies and communities?
First of all, How many of you have had an experience with a virtual world, either Second Life or maybe a game like World of Warcraft? Does everybody know what we're talking about here, more or less? Okay. A couple of important things to keep in mind about virtual worlds, and then I'll get into the whole notion of trust building within those communities. Virtual worlds are populated by citizens from around the real world. Those people are in a position of being able to jointly create social and economic environments that transcend the normal geographic boundaries of the real world. And the reason we care about that is that there's enormous potential for collaboration and public diplomacy across international borders, potential for education, and for shared value creation in a way that isn't possible in the real world given international constraints. So that's the good part. But the bad part is that it's really common in these worlds, in part because they have a background in the gaming industry, it's really common for the participants to have ambiguous and frequently anonymous identities, sometimes multiple identities. It's not uncommon in Second Life, for example, for someone to have as many as maybe 6 different avatars. So how, in that sort of context, do you develop trust in a world when there is so much potential, but trust has to be at the root of realizing that potential? We want trust because it lowers the transaction costs associated with risk. It provides a means for determining behavior. And most important for us as a business, it gives confidence in the system as a whole. So our challenge for Second Life has been to build a decentralized system, and I really want to emphasize decentralized because this can't be a top-down system or it will be completely unscalable. So we have to build a decentralized system that will retain openness and innovation and still enable trust at all levels. People don't come to Second Life just automatically trusting the system. We have to create that trust from scratch. And in thinking about identity and some of the things that have been talked about this morning, we can't do that just by maintaining focus on who you are. We have to acknowledge the fact that there's a much more complex set of questions happening here. Questions like, should I give this person the information that they're asking for? We can go into examples and such, but we've had issues of stalking, for example, when someone has trusted someone and given real-life information, and all of a sudden they discover they're being stalked in the real world. Should I take the action this person is asking of me? If not, what should I do instead? And then the counterparts to those questions, can I rely on the information I'm receiving? Is this person going to behave the way I want or expect in response to my request? And if not, what are they going to do? So for us at Linden Lab, we are in the process of looking at how we build trust on 2 different levels. First is through protection from the negative elements of society. These are the people who grief, who are fraud, committing fraud on the fringes of society, but they exist in the virtual world. In that sense, what we're talking about in terms of trust is giving people some control over what's happening. Second, we have to build trust in the guardians themselves. That would be us. Those of us at Linden Lab who are creating the conditions that determine whether or not the participants are going to be able to achieve their goals. This has become increasingly important as Second Life has become the center for economic activity. We now have somewhere close to 4,000 people who are making their real-world living in Second Life. And they need to be able to trust the system because of their economic dependence on it. So the kinds of things that we're looking at. How do we allow residents to transact with each other with a minimal fear of fraud and deception? How do we provide individuals with the means to control their own space and experience? And how do we do this and still acknowledge the jurisdictional uncertainty in the real world in the choices that we make that affect value creation, such as allowing residents to retain the intellectual property rights, the things that they create? We're looking at different kinds of technologies for reputation, accountability, relationship management. We have a code of behavior called the Community Standards. It's up on the wiki. an important thing that's come up recently is that our code of behavior was developed by us about 3.5 years ago now. And when we developed it, most of the people, in fact, probably all the people in Second Life, were from the United States. Well, that's no longer the case. And so we now need to take another look at our code of behavior, our community standards, and figure out how are we going to recognize cross-cultural norms and potentially real-world laws that govern things like privacy, hate speech, violence, political discourse. Just as an example, I have had a recent debate going with people in the forums about an individual whose name was Skinhead who had his name changed. We asked him to change his name. And a lot of people from Europe feel that we overreacted, that that was inappropriate, and that we don't have an understanding of what that might mean for them from a cultural point of view. So how will we, in developing our community standards, define codes of behavior that acknowledge these different kinds of approaches to the things that build trust and relationship? Verification or validation of identity, perhaps in solo, perhaps in tandem with larger-based identity systems on the internet, is going to be increasingly important for us. We just opened up our registration process. You can come to Second Life now for free and giving us almost no information other than an email address. There's a great deal of concern in the Second Life community about the fact that we opened registration. We believe that having more people is good, that diversity is important, and that it's that sort of openness and diversity that created the internet, and that's a model that we want to pursue. Many of our residents think we're crazy, and they're saying, you know, you're bringing in all these people, you don't know who they are. A lot of them are just alts, alternate, you know, additional accounts. They're all going to be griefers. They're going to come in and steal everything. So as governors, how do we respond to that? Well, one idea that we have is we create something that's called a verified account. That verified account might be something that says we have we can prove that this person has paid us, and because they've paid us something, that means that we have more information about them. And we won't necessarily tell you what that information is, but trust us that we now can verify that they're a real person who's made a real commitment to the community through their expenditures. That's one option. Another option might be to figure out how we integrate into some of these larger processes that people have been talking about today and use them as a source of validation. And then the last area would be internal reputation systems. In my view, those ideally would be behaviorally based as opposed to based on self-reporting. And I'm really hoping that Kevin's experiments are going to help us figure out how to do that. Finally, a big challenge for us is how do we strike a balance between our joint roles as a business entity as well as being members of the community. As a business, I, as the leader of the community, am forced into the role of benign dictator. I can't embrace some of the more idealistic notions of representative government or participatory democracy because what if everybody decided they didn't want to let any more people into Second Life? I can't do that. So I have to be a benign dictator. And that starts to create a scenario that does affect the relationship that I have with the residents. However, as a member of the community, I also need to win the trust of the residents. And we try to do that through being as transparent as possible, through the kinds of communication choices we make, and through being as fair as we can be in the way that we treat people like Mr. Skinhead. So, key to remember is that we're making these choices in a very unilateral way. While we act as governors as well as owners, we're not making these choices in the broader sorts of context that's been talked about today, and yet it's quite possible that some place like Second Life, Second Life itself, could become, if my CEO's vision is to be realized, could become the next version of the internet. But we're making these decisions today. So the choices that we make have significant implications as the virtual and the real worlds increasingly merge, as the virtual world gets increasingly large and becomes increasingly international. We need to understand at what point real governments are going to get involved and in what way. So those are just some of the questions that we're struggling with at Linden Lab.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I think these are exactly the normative questions we were considering at the very beginning. Now, let's turn to Walter. You're also engaged in a huge-scale online community-building process of a very different kind than Second Life. But I think some of the questions may be similar, right? Some of the challenges and the normative questions. Can you report about your One Laptop Per Child initiative and how it links to our discussion here?
Sure. Let me just give a little bit of background on what we're trying to do, and then I'm here more because I've got lots of questions than answers. We've started an initiative. It's called One Laptop Per Child. Some of you might know it as the $100 Laptop Project. But basically, our goal as an organization is to get laptop computers to every child in the developing world over the next decade. And part of realizing that goal is we've got to make laptops less expensive so the world can afford to do that. But we're also looking at a lot of other aspects of what that computer might do, what it's used for, how it communicates with other computers, et cetera. So what we've done is we've designed a laptop, and the basic paradigm of the laptop is create and share. So when the children open this laptop up, they're part of a mesh network. They're part of a local area network, a local Ethernet, and they have high bandwidth connectivity to each other all the time. Their teachers do as well. There's where we're deploying, there's intermittent, at best, connectivity out to the internet. So one of the things we've had to do is redefine something called service discovery, which is how does the laptop find other laptops? So for example, right now when you do a chat, you connect to a server, and that connects you to other people. If you can't connect to the server, you're out of luck. And what we want to do is let the children be connected to each other all the time. So the basic model is one where in the local community, in the community of the physical world where there's a lot of traditional physical world signaling and sort of Judas use of the word, suddenly there's going to be this overlay of a very rich virtual communication. So that's going to be the primary overlay that gets introduced. We're making this a laptop because we think that communication, learning, expressing is something that happens outside of school as much as it happens inside of school, and that learning can happen in the home. It can be infectious to the whole family and to the whole community. But what happens is that we suddenly have, in next year, we're going to be launching in seven countries, Argentina, Brazil, Nigeria, Egypt, Thailand, India, and China, with between 5 and 10 million machines. We're doing our launch in a saturation mode. So, for example, in Brazil, there are 55 million school-aged children. About 35 million of them go to the public schools. And what we're not going to do next year is give a laptop to every 50th kid. Rather, what we're going to do is we're going to pick a half a dozen regions in Brazil where every child gets a laptop. And so there's going to be this saturation model, same in all these other countries. So suddenly there's going to be, next year, again, between 5 and 10 million people on the internet that weren't there before. The year after, our goal is 50 to 100 million, and we want to hit, again, at least a billion kids over the next 10 years. So we're going to be changing the numbers quite dramatically in terms of who has access. We're also going to be changing the local communications infrastructure within the communities that we're putting these laptops. So, for example, the laptops will all be voice over IP. They'll sort of run Skype or something Skype-like. They'll run chat. They'll have every laptop will have a wiki, so every child can be both a consumer of content, also a creator of content. A lot of the applications for learning we're developing are network-based music composition that embraces a community or family of instruments, for example, one on each laptop. So that's the basic rollout, the basic thing we're building, but it raises, in my mind at least, all sorts of questions, not the least of which is how is identity expressed on these machines? Should the machines even have any kind of physical identity at all? We've been debating internally whether or not the MAC address should ever be revealed, or if we even need a physical MAC address. I've talked them out of IDing the individually IDing all the CPUs. I just said it's too expensive, and since my bill of materials is one of the drivers, that was sort of an easy argument to win. So part of it is just how identifiable are these children on the net within their community and also as they reach outside of the community. There are all sorts of issues around what does it mean to be expressive when your expression suddenly goes outside of the room and outside of the classroom and outside of the village and suddenly is part of a much broader world out there. Again, there's some mundane technical issues we're wrestling with. So, for example, there aren't enough IP addresses in IPv4 to distribute to all these children. So we're going to be using IPv6, which means we've got a different virtual naming infrastructure associated with the project than the rest of the internet is currently employing. I wanted to just say this is what we're building. So we're really building a quite substantial community. Our primary goal is children learning and learning primarily through their own expression and sharing and communicating with each other and with their teachers. And I know that there are lots of things we need to wrestle with and lots of questions I haven't asked yet, so I'm hoping that all of you can ask some of those questions and help me find some of the answers.
Thank you very much. We have time for two questions, and one is over there, as I can see.
That would be me, Dick Hart from Skip. Like what all the presenters had to say, but I have a question for Robin. Second Life, great phenomena, wickedly cool stuff, and you talk around wanting to have the identity stuff being decentralized and open. Wondering what your plans are for blurring the boundary around the Second Life world so people could take identity reputation data that they may have gained in some other part of the internet and bring that into Second Life, and conversely be able to take the reputation, identity, and maybe even possessions they have from Second Life out into other parts of the internet? Or are you planning on building another large silo?
No, we don't believe in walled gardens. And we've been talking through various different organizations, the Accelerating Change, for example, is talking about the metaverse. There are different groups who are interested in creating some sort of way for you to create an identity that you can take with you from virtual world to virtual world. I don't know what that's going to look like, and I don't know who's going to actually build it, but I do believe that we will participate as it evolves.
Okay, there is another question over here.
This is a follow-up, but what about virtual world to real world? We look at the identity layer as a solvent across accounts. So one use case is maybe if I have an account at Google, I can use that account with my MSN services, and they trust each other and they have a trust relationship. So you talked about having identities go from Second Life to other virtual worlds, but what about real world accounts and looking at getting into trust relationships with other businesses, Yahoo, Google, AOL, et cetera?
Certainly that's a possibility. I'm not aware of any of them having been indicating any interest in doing something like that. But if they would, I think what where it would really be helpful to us would be in the sort of verified accounts that I was talking about, because it would be another way that we could say, you know, this account has done something that suggests that they can be trusted. You know, it would go beyond just having paid Linden Lab, for example. It might open up a whole other tier of residents to be validated, if you will. So, yeah, we're very open. We are trying very hard to find ways to integrate wherever we can across the web with other organizations, wherever it makes sense for us as a business, as well as for the community.
Great. Unfortunately, we have to come to an end. It's 4:30, and the next panel should be here and get started. So join me, please, in thanking our panelists for their